time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for January 11th, 2020. Not much time for chit-chat today because my guest this week, who really doesn't need much of an introduction if you know anything about frame building and legendary people in our cycling world, is Richard Sachs. I last spoke with Richard in 2015 when we met voice-to-voice for breakfast to talk about his commentary on adjusting the torch. Today we're going to see where those adjustments have taken him as we discuss Richard Sachs 3.0. Hello, Richard. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Do you know that it's been almost 4 years since we actually had a face-to-face, well, voice-to-voice chat?
Wow. Well, thanks for having me back, Diane. It doesn't seem like 4 years, but here we go.
Here we go. And last time we spoke, we were having breakfast because we spoke early in the morning, and you had just published a piece titled Adjusting the Torch, which I thought was wonderful. So I figured we should go look back and see what the flame looks like now, because I listened to that interview again.
And good. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm wondering where you're thinking about your craft and the state of the handmade artisan world is, and what is the state of the torch these days?
Well, obviously, it's just my perspective and not, you know, the worldview. I don't really know the state of the torch these days or anymore. I kind of feel like the zeitgeist or the energy flow that started maybe at the beginning of the century kind of came and went, you know, with all the bike shows, with all the frame builder forums, the social media, the listservs, the little clicks, you know, those things. I kind of feel that it's all subsided and everybody who's left kind of has retreated. You know, we all have our alliances and our opinions, but I don't feel that the growth that people maybe spoke about 10 or 15 years ago is showing any evidence now. There are obviously people that made it to the other side, so, you know, they are the exceptions. But in terms of the wider numbers of people perhaps jump-starting another generation of frame building, I don't see it from where I sit. But that's not a judgment either. That's simply my, you know, perspective.
Yeah, but I think your perspective has some worldview behind it. You've been in this world so long since you were really young, and you watched it ebb and flow and ebb and flow. And it really was this sort of explosion beginning about 15 years ago, maybe. And so when I look at hand builders today, people who are crafts people, and some are women, some are men, there are a few people still doing it. But are you thinking that the public isn't looking at the craft bicycle so much? Or are you thinking the artisan builder himself or herself isn't as, what's the word I'm looking for? There aren't as many of them.
Well, yes, no, and maybe to all of that. It's kind of different. I wrestled with that for a while because I came, you know, like I actually don't feel like I'm an older person than the people that I hang out with at the shows or at the races, but in years I am. So I came into this kind of from a different window. First and last of all, you know, I didn't want to be a bike maker. I just became one. So that's a separate story. So my motivations and the motivations of almost everybody I know who makes bicycles, you know, they're completely different. I also came in to the trade when it was a trade. Nobody spoke about it like it was a craft or a creative endeavor or part of the decorative arts or some of those things I say all the time when I write. But it was a job of work, and you studied or you practiced or you trained or you did all those things. And eventually, when you were good enough to maybe do everything from one end to the other, the people that you were working with, which was in most cases a production environment, let you do more. And then when you were so sick of doing more for somebody else, you decided to either quit or start your own little thing and reduce the, you know, the burden of having to deal with people. You went from a production shop into something that would be more independent. That's how, you know, I saw frame building. Most of the guys who were, quote, frame builders came out of, you know, a larger work environment and stayed independent and small. They didn't want to, like, become the entity that they left, because that the point was to have more independence and to, like, listen to your own voice. So that's kind of, like, where I came from. I also came from an era when everything was tied to the sport, and it was unthinkable that people who made bicycles for a living didn't know everything that had to be known about racing, good design, rider position, morphology, turning, descending, you know, all those kind of things that have to do with how a bike handles. The contrast to that is that in the current, you know, era, it seems like people just want to make something, which is fine. That's, like I said before, that's not a judgment or anything. It's just my observation. And now people come into it because they want to take material and make something from it. In the case of this conversation, we're talking about bicycle frames. So that's the difference. I've realized that no matter how much, you know, I talk about how it used to be, that isn't the case any longer. So what we have left are people that may not have the same motivations to drive it forward, you know, for a lifetime, the way maybe some of us did. They might want to do it, see how it goes. Doesn't work out, or they get interested in something else, they leave. So there's a lot of differences between the personality types of the nows and the thens.
Very interesting. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Richard Sachs. We're sort of looking at the philosophy of the way he views his frame building work. We'll just call it that, because you did say it was a job and it was work, and that you have this immersion in the sport, which is something I want to talk about as we progress with this conversation, because one of the things you do is you still sponsor a team, and that's a really interesting and I think important point that goes to what you were just saying. And the people who today are maybe, I mean, I don't know if I'd call it dabbling, but maybe, you know, people get into frame building because it looks cool or it looks sexy. I'm a maker, I'm an engineer, and they're leaving out a part. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Well, they're leaving out a part that I didn't, like, try to bring that part into what I do. It simply was, like, completely overlapping with what I did when I started. In other words, racing and bicycle making were synergistic. So somebody would say, well, this guy never raced, but he had like an alignment with the sport. Mr. Honda, the founder of Honda, was, well, his quote is, and I use it like all the time, maybe too much, racing improves the breed. And for most of my life, I thought that was a quote that came from Enzo Ferrari. And then about a decade ago, I actually Googled it and I realized, you know, it's from Japan. Regardless, you know, the racing bike helps define all bikes in terms of how something will behave, how something will, like I said before, corner, you know, how it will fit the rider. It's just slower when you don't race. And not everybody has to race or should be involved with racing anymore to succeed. But in the time that I came into it, that was, you know, part of the conversation.
Well, that brings up a question for me. When I look at that quote, racing improves the breed, the industry has often said, well, we start with Super Record and let it trickle down to Chorus or to whatever. We start with DI2 and let it, or Dura-Ace and let it trickle down to 105. So is that what might happen if you start with racing and then out of that comes a lot of the idea for anybody else who wants to get on a bicycle?
Well, I can only speak for myself. All of my decisions, and even the aesthetic ones, the ones that have to do with what a bicycle looks like or should look like with my name on it,
yep,
come from the sport. And, you know, I've been doing this so long that I couldn't even explain to you what that means. It's just part of my intuition. So you're just going to have to, like, let me roll with that. In 2019, much less, you know, even 10 years ago, you couldn't say shit like this. But racing is where the sex is. And mindset of race on Sunday, sell on Monday, that's not, you know, some made-up phrase. That's basically the way, like, all the brands work. And the successes that you have, you know, at the track or on the playing field are the ones that you can best bring to market during the week and then go back on the next weekend and try to improve on your lot, you know, in race results or, you know, finishes or whatever, even if it's a tweak apart or, you know, to shave a gram or to find a different way for a bearing to fit into a bicycle. All these things come from, like, pushing the boundaries of the product, which is a bicycle. That's kind of like what I feel. I don't think people generally feel this way. They probably hear this kind of talk and think, that's a language I don't understand at all. So I'm okay with that because it took a while, but I finally, you know, I myself got to the other side of being maybe more tolerant than I was 10 or 15 years ago about the whole thing. And I realized that, you know, people's motivations are simply different. And if they want to make a bike that never gets raced, if they have no interest in the sport and still want to make bikes and still think that they can make great bikes, hey, that's wonderful. I mean that sincerely. So I think that's what we have now. A lot of people making very few bikes at a time. Most of them seem quite beautiful. I can't say anything about their construction quality or their design parameters because I don't think these people have the depth of experience of as a maker to know too much about their you know, the bicycles, except that they were making beautiful bicycles, which in and of itself, I guess in 2019 is probably good enough.
We're going to take a real quick break. We're going to be right back to talk with Richard some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Just joining me, I've been speaking with Richard Sachs. I love talking with him because I like the way he thinks. And if you didn't hear the first half of this conversation, I think that it would behoove you to go back and listen to it because where we're going to pick it up is kind of, I think, an interesting point. So I want to start again with the way I know you've built bikes and the way I know my husband Brian builds bikes. And he has spent, I've known him 22 years. He has spent all those years looking at learning, working with design and geometry and handling and those kinds of things. What I heard you say before was maybe people didn't think as much about handling and design and geometry and fit and all of those things.
Well, you kind of have to because a bicycle is a vehicle. People may not want to acknowledge that, but, you know, you make a vehicle that goes on the open road with, like, you know, cars and trucks and mopeds and, you know, the rules of the road. And, you know, you have a bike path if you're lucky. But the thing is, you're still out there. So the bike has to have some kind of characteristics that allow it to handle a certain way and allow it to last a certain amount of time without it becoming a liability. And I feel that those kind of things are not possible without some amount of repetition and routine. However, you know, like I said before, I'm kind of on the other side. So most people who come into it, you know, they would hear me say this or read, you know, something I wrote like 5 years ago, 15 years ago, and they think, oh, you know, here we go again, you know, this guy, which is fine. I don't even care to tell you the truth. I mean, my vigilance for trying to help people get it right has come and gone. You know, I have my own off-internet community of people that I work with and mentor. But trying to do it as kind of a more public figure in the form of e-lists or whatever they're called, listservs and message boards like we used to, you know, I gave up on that like 10 years ago because it's just like no matter what you say, somebody who hasn't done anything will say, this is the way I do it. And then it becomes a thing. And then you have to like wonder, do I like drop the gloves and get involved with this thing and like tell this guy he doesn't have a clue? Or to some of my peers with the same amount of experience who are also like-minded, get in there and, you know, start a word ruckus regarding like what you know and what you don't know. Or you simply like think, hey, screw it. I got mine. I hope he gets his or hers. And, you know, that's kind of where I left it like 8 or 10 years ago. And I kind of left it in a good way. I'm not trying to like say that my way is the way or the only way and nothing else will work because it simply doesn't matter anymore. I kind of feel like frame building, and this is me maybe taking the conversation to a different place, but frame building used to be the top of the food chain in the bicycle industry. You go to trade shows, you read magazines, and the most renowned, the most sought names and brands or the people that made frames. And that doesn't mean they labored over them one at a time, like, you know, I ended up doing. They could have been the Colnagos and the Mazzis and, you know, the Bianchis of the world. Because they're frame builders too, and a lot of people don't like to think that way because they think of them as factories or sellouts or, you know, one guy who hasn't, like, you know, been at a workbench for 40 years making money off of branding. But I think of those people as, you know, the people whose shoulders we all stood on, and I still do, but, you know, that's kind of a moot point after a while. I think that, you know, I'm kind of like rambling here, but you have to make a lot of bikes to know stuff. And if you don't want to, like, you know, get into it, then you've kind of made your decision or fate will have its way with you. And, you know, where you are in 5 or 15 years will be something we'll have to come back and visit, you know, when those years pass. But it's not working the same way it once did. And, you know, like, that's the way it goes.
Where you keep things relevant and where I don't see some others is in your team. Going back to your idea of supporting the sport and building frames that will be raced, what is it that has kept you finding new riders and supporting them and building them frames and putting kits on them and going out and racing, especially cross, which seems to be, of course, you're in New England and New England is sort of the home of cyclocross. And you have a team that is so standout. Everybody knows your team. So why do you keep sponsoring teams? How has it helped you?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to like walk away from it simply because I don't have to do it anymore. I probably haven't had to do it in 20 years. I've been doing it for the last 40. I started in 81, and now it's 2020. So, you know, that's a good long run.
Yep.
For those who don't know, the reason I did it was because we had a club, and we had a hole in our sponsorship program, and one of the writers asked me if I would kind of pick up the slack with my flame building company. And I said, yeah, it's pretty much all there was to it. You know, like when I was racing full-time in the 70s, which was, it was a different, you know, type of racing, but it was still the elite level racing, Cat 1s, Cat 2s. You know, we always had sponsorship. And I kind of felt like, you know, it's important to keep these things going because these people sponsored me. I got the benefit of this experience and learning to do stuff and traveling pretty much on the backs of somebody else's, like, checkbook, you know, some of the brands. And, you know, when it came time for me to, like, answer my friend's question about, like, would I pick up the tab, I said, sure. So the first year I made a few frames. The second year we made a few more frames. And before you know it, like, we had this thing going. And for, like, the first 15 or 20 years was only road racing because Cross hadn't really developed in America the way it is now. So by the time 95, 96 came around, we were double dipping with both disciplines. And we had quite the success going, you know, through the years. And that success made it easier for us in the off season to kind of hustle industry people, whether it was helmet sponsors or wheel companies or tire suppliers or saddle makers, whatever it was. You go out there with your team, show that you're trying, and, you know, get a couple of photographs, because back in the day there was no internet or social media. You send a letter of thanks, whatever it is. And they're like, oh my God, we have to do this next year. You'll have us back, won't you? And I'm thinking, wait, you'll have us back.
Right.
And I'm thinking, we want to be with you. And before I knew it, by the 2003-2004 era, we were turning away industry people because we already had this part of the bike or that part of the bike. And by then we were starting to like get into real money sponsorship. We had Brown and Sharp from New England. We had the watch company RGM from Pennsylvania. We had Simple Human from Southern California. That evolved into, and in a kind of a circuitous way, my relationship with House Industries, which was in place anyway, but I kind of thought, like, I got to get these people involved because we got this good thing going, and by then it was almost 25 years. So somehow, you know, between a logo and branding redesign that I was doing with them or they were doing for me, we took that relationship and turned it into, you know, kind of what people know now. So since then, my relationship with House and their relationship with a much wider audience in the design world has begot us the kind of sponsorship that I would imagine people kind of fantasize about. So the organization now kind of has its own life. I could probably say that I have two jobs and they both pay equally well and they both take equally as much time and, you know, be completely truthful with that. Because the racing team is a full-time gig, and making frames for, like, paying customers is a full-time gig. So now we have House Industries, we have Design Within Reach, we have Herman Miller, we have Rafa helping us with apparel, and we still have the long list of families like Douglas Brooks and his yoga, Wajanika Yoga. We have Rex Chu, who's a physician in Menlo Park. His practice helps us. We have a man named Samuel Chun in St. Louis who has a consulting business called Radix. And we also have a lot of people that just, and this is the cool part, who want to be involved with giving us money to keep us in the black, but don't want to be like a known entity. So it's kind of like that viewers like you thing that PBS says when they do their pledge drives.
Right, right.
We have a fair amount of people that just send checks because they believe this is such a good thing with us providing a table that racers year in and year out can dine at, that they want to help it. And next year it'll be 40 years that I've been doing it. So the wider picture includes that even if we don't win, and we do win, but we don't win as often as maybe we'd like to, just the fact that we're fielding a team and we have like an agenda and a mission statement for 5 or 6 months of the year, that alone is worth more than any freaking dollar I could spend on an ad or at a trade show or anything. And people may think, well, that's easy for you to say. You've been doing this for so long. And I'm thinking, like, anybody could do this. Anybody. Just start, you know, keep your eye on, like, what you're doing. Don't vacillate or don't I don't even know what to say.
Maybe don't be wishy-washy.
Yeah, don't be wishy-washy. You know, you want to do something like this, and I guarantee you that it's actually a feel-good thing that pays dividends. So, like, which comes first? At this point in my life, they're both so commingled that there is no first. It just works. And it's really probably over time, if I think about what decisions I made for my business that have been good ones, putting myself in the racing community as like one of the players and not relenting when Trek come along or Specialized comes along or any of these other companies, or even when it's hard to like hustle up enough time to make new frames for people and you still have to like, you know, start the season, you know, in the next month or two, just do it. And I'm using kind of like a $20 word here, but the aura that comes with doing it will help you in your bicycle business. And I'm loath to use the term branding because I think some people are so young and new that they think that's kind of like an adult word. But you're in the business, you're making frames, you're not making them for free, you want to have more money than you spent when your customer pays you, and you want to have more customers after he gets his bike, and you want to keep going. So it is a business. So to me, this is like part of like a small amount of business advice that I would give anybody. Even if you just say, I'm gonna sponsor one kid each year, whatever it is. So anyway, I don't really want to stay on the soapbox and like tell people that, you know, racing is, you know, the reason everything works so well. But it certainly has been something that has worked well for me to be part of it.
We're going to take another short break and get back to our conversation with Richard Sachs. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
I'm Diane Jenks, and we've been talking this week with Richard Sachs. We're gonna leave racing for a minute, but I have one more thing to say, and that is the partnerships that you have made or that have come to you. Because in a lot of cases, as you said, you have quote-unquote silent partners, people who just want to support the idea of Richard Sachs Racing Team. Is something that you've built, you know, people might look at it and say, oh, he's doing this or that. It's been 40 years, so you've stuck with it, and people know you will be there year after year. And I think that stands for a lot. Good on you, Richard. Good on you.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I would do it regardless because first, last, and foremost, the reason I started doing it was because somebody helped me. My friend Nick Dislin, who was once one of the people at Wordcom USA, and then after that with a few other brands that he managed or was an agent for or imported. Through the 70s, Nick was the guy who kept us, you know, the riders and our little team, moving forward. He and his wife, Lisa, rest in peace, were like the people who made sure that we had clothes, that we had tires, that we knew where we were going, you know, we had rides, you know, all that kind of stuff. And by the way, racing in the 70s was much more quaint and low-key than it is now, but the principle is what I'm kind of getting at. When I realized that, you know, our team by 79 or 80 had started to, like, fray, and, you know, I didn't really give it much thought at that point because we had a good long run, and I wasn't even out of my 20s at that point. However, my friend Martin, hey, Martin, if you're listening, he said to me, well, why don't you do this? And, like, as I said, there was no other answer except, yeah, that's a great idea. Count me in.
There is no there.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I want to take a left turn or a right turn, depending on, yeah, I'm left-handed, so I always say left turn. And,
okay.
And I want to talk a moment about some of the spring cleaning you seem to be doing. So I'm watching.
Oh, God, yeah.
I'm watching all of these amazing parts and pieces and accessories appear on your Facebook feed, such as campy record derailleurs and dropouts and pump heads and big plastic spoke protectors that used to go behind freewheels. And I'm wondering, what do you think when you see these things? What does it evoke in you?
Well, you know, we're going to probably have to do this in three parts. I have all this stuff in the loft from moving back to Connecticut 3 or 4 years ago that I thought I jettisoned in the aughts, AUGHTS, et cetera. When I made my huge purge, I went through the 80s and 90s, like, saving and collecting NOS and IP parts because I thought they were so beautiful. I never collected anything to use. I collected it only because the ephemera, you know, the packaging, the actual stuff inside the box was something that I thought was, like, you know, like when I talk about bring back the elegance, I think of bike parts from those eras. Now, on the other side, I would never want to ride a bike with that stuff. I'm not one of those vintage guys, okay? I just want to make that clear. I only use modern stuff with 12-speed and, you know, carbon fiber wheels and all those things. But to me, as a maker, as a human being, as somebody who has pretty strong female side. I'm also kind of an effete elitist. I love branding. I love retail. I love fashion. I love art, but I don't really know enough about art to, like, have a conversation. But when beauty finds me, I stop dead in my tracks. So to bring it back to this conversation, in my trade, Campagnolo made beautiful parts. And now everything is beautiful if you're maybe 20 or 30, but to me it just looks pretty much like appliances. So I got it in my head early to start either saving or procuring or doing horse trades for stuff in boxes because I didn't want stuff that came off bikes. I don't want anything used. I don't want anything that didn't have a little nest of carton beauty to sit or fit in between. And before I know it, I had, like, closets and storerooms full of stuff. And this is before the internet. This is back when eBay was still, like, in the dial-up era. So somehow or another, I had, like, become, like, oh, my God, what's going to happen when kind of, like, I stop breathing? Like, what's going to happen to all this stuff? I used to go into my room and look at it and, like, fondle it. You know, they kind of look like Orson Welles and I forget the name of the movie. Maybe you can remind me. Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane. Thank
you. So he had his attachment to his sled.
Redbud.
Yeah. Okay. So for me, I couldn't buy or trade enough to get more. And then one day, out of the blue, you know, it was 2007, 2008. You know, I did another trot into my storeroom or where all the stuff was kept, And it's all these boxes, yellow boxes, blue boxes, Cinelli stuff, you know, Clement stuff, salesman samples, everything. All of it was new. And I thought to myself, what the absolute fuck have I done? Because in that one moment, like, the luster ended. Now, I wasn't going to jettison it. I wasn't going to give it away. I was in this for the money, so to speak, even though I never had planned to sell it. And that all changed. I started listing it on eBay back when the rates for selling were fairly decent. And I got a taste of like getting rid of a few things that I thought I had too many of, like duplicates and replicas of the same derailleur or the same brake set. And I got a taste of money. And before I knew it, I was as interested in other people's money for my vintage stuff as I was for my vintage stuff 10, 15, 20 years before that. I got rid of all of it. And honestly, Diane, when I say all of it, I thought all of it. Now, last week I went into the loft, which is, you know, we're three buildings away and two states away from where all this began, like in the 80s and 90s. I found stuff that I didn't know I had. So what I'm like metering out on Instagram and Facebook right now are dribs and drabs of things that I used to have like more of than I even want to think about at this point. So I thought it would be kind of fun using my social media pages to kind of like, take a picture, write some pithy comment, and see what the conversations about it become afterwards. So that's what you're talking about. I have no plan to sell the few things that are left unless somebody says I'll give you $2 million. But I don't have enough here that the money that I would get for selling it, even at a good profit, that money doesn't really mean anything at this point in my life. So keeping some of this stuff around and putting it back in the boxes is probably what's going to happen. And I haven't, I've only been doing that for a week or two. So you've probably seen maybe 14 or 15 posts. And I could do it for another month and still, you know, not replicate anything. But I'm not kind of trying to get back into the market and be kind of a profiteer. It's just kind of like beautiful things that I'm sharing with people.
Well, it's interesting. I can remember when we had our shop back in the day and we had showcases, and you'd take a set of Campy brakes and a crank and derailleurs and shifters, and you'd put them in the case, and it was like, they were like, and hubs, they were like jewelry. And that's the way I thought of them too, these magnificent pieces, parts. And I agree with you, when I look at today's components, they work extremely well. You know,
oh, yeah,
certainly,
they work better than they ever did.
Sure, the technical capabilities are amazing, but they don't have, and I'll use Richard's words, the elegance that I remember, you know, plucking a pair of 32-hole Campy hubs, large flange hubs out of a box. They were beautiful.
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on here in this conversation, and it all has to do with frame building too, because what you're talking about regarding how things work, I think of that in terms of the frames too. I think that the crossroads, I think the roads of making and manufacturing kind of intersected, and the bikes that come from the major manufacturers now are better than most of the frames that come from people that have made a few and are trying to have a go at, you know, a business. And, you know, people don't like to hear that because it sounds a little condescending to the people that are trying to make a little business. But the reality is the Trex, the Specialized, the Giants, the Canyons of the world have thrown a lot of money and energy at racing the way frame building used to. They're the ones that have benefited because frame building pretty much died a slow death in the 90s and, you know, the early zeros, and eventually kind of turned back. But everybody who was like doing it then wasn't doing it afterwards. So you have a new group of people that didn't embrace the repetition and routine concept that I'm so vigilant about. And they had no ties to racing. And in the contrast to that, all the manufacturers were really scooping up, like the teams and the riders and whatnot. And all the ads you see for like stuff now, they show people riding like manufactured products. So the components look good on manufactured bikes, but they don't really look that good on handmade bikes. And part of my challenge is I kind of like what I do, and I think my bikes are cutting edge, even though they are steel, and even though they're brazed by hand, and even though they have lugs. But the shape of it, the aesthetic of it from, you know, the 10 feet away, it still looks like, you know, a bike that may have been made like 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. Now, trying to assemble a frame that I made now or last week with components that are basically made for Trek shapes or Cannondale shapes or, you know, Stevens or Canyon or whatever, it's really hard for me to, like, look at the bikes now with some of these things that, to me, like I said before, look like appliances. So that's my biggest challenge, is how to continue doing what I want and like to do, and also be able to assemble it into a complete bicycle and also appreciate what it looks like, because they have to look good to me too.
I could not agree with you more. That's a tough one. That's a tough one.
I'm rolling with it the best I can. And I kind of thought like 3 or 4 years ago, I kind of felt like I was still in my own game. Now, when the shapes of cranks and, you know, derailleurs are now made with huge pulleys, and there's this trend towards compact gearing in the front and, like, mega selections in the back, and I'm thinking, geez, at what point do you want to make the bike so freaking easy to pedal that it's not even exercise anymore? Because everything now is about, like, how low a gear can you have and, you know, not have, like, four chain rings on the front. And I'm thinking, like, it's supposed to be like a human-powered thing, and if it gets any easier, you might as well just get a moped. But, you know, somewhere in the last year or so, that I read that, you know, being sarcastic is a personality trait that will help you live longer, because you think there are more a different lens than other people. And if that's the case, I'll probably live quite long, because I've become so sarcastic about this trade that it's amazing that I don't get just really pushed out by, you know, the people that I buy parts from. So, you know, maybe that would be a good thing. So.
I think the aesthetics have become very difficult to deal with on what I would call a classically built frame. And I know that somebody like Jan Hein, who's trying very hard to bring back things like, I mean, it's not going to happen. He's not going to bring back down tube shifters. I don't care what he thinks. I think that's probably pie in the sky. But, you know, you have people like White Industries still making a silver polished hub, which I still think is beautiful. I like
them. Yeah. I mean, I applaud anybody that's throwing themselves into the ring and trying to keep things going. I mean, I myself tried to do that and have been doing it since 2001 with my. I have a separate business of just frame building parts that I sell to other frame builders,
right,
who couldn't possibly have the capital to do this themselves. So in a way, I'm trying to keep frame building, quote unquote, alive and moving forward by, you know, having cast parts and tubing from Columbus that allows people to simply make bikes. They don't have to think about where their next lug is going to come from or their next fork round. Because in the 90s, it was starting to look like nobody was going to be replenishing the shelves, because things were going to non-ferrous material. They were going to welding. They were going to sourcing from factories overseas. And the actual playlist that frame builders had to use to, you know, get their, you know, quote, unquote, you know, tunes from, or their ingredients from, was diminishing. And I thought, like, geez, I've only been doing it at this point, like, I don't know, however many years I was doing it in 2001, that might have been 28 years. I felt like it's sink or swim, because it's not going to get any better unless I start spending some of my own money. And of course, the driver was I wanted to, you know, have my own supply. But the carrot was also, well, if I do this for myself and sell this to other people, I can actually make money. And when I got a taste of that, I felt like, this is not so bad. And I kept going with it. Now I have about 28 or 30 different cast pieces that not everybody knows about, because I don't really promote it, you know, full time the way I should. But, you know, that's fine. You know, I have enough people around the world that buy lugs and tubing and stuff for me that, you know, I'm happy with, you know, the business.
So the last thing I want to talk about is 2020 and moving, looking, seeing forward. What's going to be new for Richard Sacks this year? Anything? Or are you going to just keep on keeping on?
Well, I'll answer your question best I can. I don't know how much time you have allotted to this, but for the sake of people listening, I had this long list through most of the aughts that, you know, mushroomed at about 6 or 7 years. There were many different versions of how long my wait list was on the internet, but very little of it was true, because, you know, I only participate in my conversation with my customers. And sometimes, you know, it becomes an internet meme that, you know, he doesn't take orders, or he's quit, or he's retiring, or he has a 15-year wait list, and he doesn't tell people how much it's going to cost, whatever. I finally got to the end of that list last January. Well, my plan was to, like, take a breather, which I did, hit the reset button, which I did, and at June 2019, I started from scratch. Now, there were a few people that were stragglers from the first list that couldn't make up their mind and, you know, just told me to, you know, keep the space open until they're ready. But that's like, you know, fewer than 10. So essentially, you know, I rebuilt my backlog or my queue starting from this past summer. And I decided going forward that the prudent thing to do was only to take maybe a year's worth of business in at a time, then close it, and then put it up on my site. You know, when I get close to the end of that list, you know, I'm starting over. And then I'll see how that goes at this point in my life. Because it's not like I'm about to walk away from anything. I'm going to be doing this full time until, you know, that last day. And then whoever frame is like half, well, I'm lying on the floor, they could decide what to do with it. But you know, there's no, you know, like some of my peers have retired. Good on them. I wish them well. I really like what I do. I have a lot of energy for trying to keep this one type of bike I make vibrant and desirable, and hopefully have some of my enthusiasm rub off on one or two other people, and maybe keep them mentored in such a way that they can maybe get a piece of this for themselves, because I don't think frame building as I knew it going in 71, 72, and through the years is the same as it is now, and it's kind of a tough business. But I think, you know, if I could hand over enough opinions, enough raw materials, enough, you know, picture pages, enough conversations privately with a few people, and, you know, one guy or a few people, few women, whatever, can walk away with something and use it as a building block, then that's fine. So that's kind of where I'm at. You know, keep the racing thing going, keep the frame building thing going, you know, keep the social media thing going. It's all kind of fun. So
let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Richard Sacks. Are you going to Philly?
Actually, the pre-reg started yesterday, and my decision for Philly kind of, actually, were you there last year?
I was not.
I forget. Okay, so we took three booths at Philly, and we had basically a row, and the idea was I'm not going as Richard Sacks Cycles. I'm going there to represent Richard Sacks Cyclocross Team. So we went really deep into the resources of my sponsors. We had like a pop-up aisle that represented House Industries, Design Within Reach, Herman Miller, myself, Rafa, and I don't know if that's the kind of thing that you can keep doing. So thinking of going back basically and like keeping my little corner rather than to have this large car show like ordeal that we did. And to answer your question another way, my sponsorship family of brands and I are thinking of is to take the show out of the cycling industry and maybe kind of place it into like an art museum or a design fair or someplace where people who are not cyclists could see the synergy that happens between four or five like-minded brands and kind of raise the awareness and, to use a friend's term, maybe get more eyeball or get more reach by taking this into a different world and try that.
I love it.
So we'll see.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah.
I kind of miss seeing you. I haven't seen you in a few years. And I would be interested to know if you decide to do this sort of along the art and market, you know, branding, whatever you want to call it. I'd like to see it, I think, and I'd like to be present for it. It sounds really smart.
It's kind of like racing for me. I quit road racing in 2002 because I just got so sick of going to the same towns on the same weekends and making the same left-hand turns with the same people just a year older or 4 years older. And that's kind of like, you know, I gave up on it because, like, how many, and I'm paying to do this, for God's sakes. For me, you know, even when the show's thing started in that, like, 2006, 2007 era, I was already, like, firmly established with my team and with my brand that I wasn't going to these places to, like, pick up orders or to, like, you know, find, like, a wider reach. I did it to support the community and maybe get, you know, have a nice little vacation at a town that I've never been to. And it's the same thing now. I kind of feel like we've done all these same shows with the same people for so long that if cycling and handmade frame building is going to expand, we have to find a different audience rather than the cyclists who were trying to siphon off of, like, LBSs who sell Treks and Cannondales. There might be people out there that just really appreciate something finely made, something unique, something that is produced by, like, a one-man environment who has strong convictions about how things should look and how things should be going together. And those people, I think, are the people that don't go to bicycle conventions or bike races. They're simply aficionados of craft or fine design or beautiful things. And with my relationship with House Industries and Design Within Reach, I kind of feel like we've been doing that for about 10 years with that, you know, relationship. So why not just start going to venues or create a venue? And even if it's a pop-up thing that lasts 2 weeks, the vibe and the energy that could come from that could dwarf, you know, what we might do if the same people that go to bike shows every year see the same, you know, bikes and the same wheels and the same people. I think it might be time to, like, just completely separate from that and go a different direction. So that's a long way of saying I haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah, but I like it. I like it.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is the thought process, actually, and to see where your mind is going with it. It's fascinating. You know, it's too bad we're not in the same town so that we could just, like, go to the pub, have a beer, and keep talking.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, yeah. I don't have a Skype or any of that kind of stuff, but I usually send a picture of my scotch glass to some of my friends when we sit down at 5:30 or 6 o'clock and toast them because it's scotch o'clock. So I'll find you later when I go into the house, and I'll pour a glass and send you an image, and I'll toast you.
Okay, and then when Brian pours bourbon tonight, we'll toast you back.
Oh, you're bourbon people. Okay.
Because we have a whole slew of friends down in Kentucky. Richard, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. It is always a pleasure to talk with you and to learn what you're up to. You take care of yourself.
Okay, thanks, Diane.
All right.
Best to everybody out there. See ya.
Bye-bye. I really enjoyed talking with Richard, and it will be interesting to see where he's headed in the months and years to come. We'll be back next week with Eve and Roger from the Georgia Tandem Rally and a lot more. Thanks for listening. Oh, and last week I wondered if you had gotten or were getting a new bike this year. And while most of you actually said no, there were some interesting yeses, including a new tandem and some sexy-sounding gravel machines in some people's lives. So this week's question, are you riding steel, carbon, or aluminum? Go on out to our Facebook page if you're interested and weigh in. You can also send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without the E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Although the website's been down the past couple of days with an issue with our server. I hope you have a great week. Remember to stay safe out there, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.